Hey, Bill Nye, the Science Guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deedy, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Sam, a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
It's September 22nd, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine. Folks, it's official. Fall is here. And in Albany, New York, which is where I am podcasting from this month, you can definitely feel it and you can definitely see it. The leaves are starting to change a little bit. So we've got a great show for you this month. As I mentioned last month, we'll be playing the question and answer portion of Bill Nye, the Science Guy's talk as he received the Humanist of the Year at AHA's 69th annual conference, which took place earlier this summer in San Jose, California. We're also going to be talking about an event that the American Humanist Association is hosting toward the end of October. But first, we're going to play a clip of an interview that I just did with Jason Fry, who is the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego, as well as the coordinator of the LGBT Humanist Council. That's the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgendered Council, which is a project of the American Humanist Association. So as you can tell, Jason wears lots of hats. Let's hear a little bit more about them. Okay, listeners, we're here with Jason Fry, who is the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego, as well as the coordinator for the LGBT Humanist Council. Jason, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here, Jess.
First, can you give our listeners just a little bit of background of the organization that you come from, the Humanist Association of San Diego?
Certainly. Chartered by the AHA as a chartered chapter in October 1973, the Humanist Association of San Diego has a threefold approach to humanist community organizing and activism. We call it fellowship, education, and advocacy. On the fellowship side, it's about community building. On the education side, we have a monthly lecture series that's featured people such as Dr. Daryl Ray, author of The God Virus, and Joe Nickel of the Center for Inquiry. And we have the advocacy side. In our history, we've done some pretty spectacular things. In 1922, the Ku Klux Klan erected a cross on a mountain in San Diego, Mount Soledad, the Mount Soledad cross. They burned it down. And then in the 1950s, a church group erected a cross on Mount Soledad, the current cross that's up there. They did it without a vote of the city's public property. And they dedicated it to on Easter Sunday to our eternal Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. A couple of years ago, the Congress declared eminent domain, and right now it's a federal issue. The ACLU is duking it out. But we've taken on political issues like that. We've been involved with the city council. We worked with the city council to have Mayor Jerry Sanders proclaim February 12, 2009 as Charles Darwin Day. And I delivered, as a humanist celebrant and president of the Humanist Association, I delivered the first humanist invocation to our city council. And this is going to be a wonderful conversation between us, because on that day, I think it was October 27, 2008, that was the day the city council voted not to endorse Proposition 8. Ironically, they had asked me months and months in advance, and it just so happened on that day, an LGBT rights activist and humanist celebrant myself delivered the invocation on the day they voted not to endorse Proposition 8. I received a standing ovation, and the city clerk said she had never heard an invocator receive applause before. So that was a lot of fun.
Nice. Now, you wear a couple different hats in the humanist community. Can you also talk about your role with the LGBT Humanist Council?
My role with the LGBT Humanist Council, currently I'm the spokesperson and coordinator for the LGBT Humanist Council. The AHA has been putting a lot of work recently into directing a concerted effort to promoting the philosophy of humanism's obligation to LGBT rights. There are several key issues that we're interested in. Family issues are something that I'm interested in directing us and the council to work on. Family issues, including adoption rights. Luckily, today, a court in Florida ruled that a same-sex couple adoption ban in Florida was unconstitutional. Other issues are Social Security, survivor benefits, spousal immigration rights, and, of course, marriage. So several years back in California, we had a constitutional amendment that made marriage between a man and a woman in the state of California. In 2008, the California Supreme Court ruled that this gender discrimination was unconstitutional. Several months later, a group of well-funded individuals put together $40 million, and the battle of the rhetoric began. On the one side, you had the LGBT activist essentially passively saying, can we please have our rights? Can we please have marriage equality? And the other side had something absolutely sinister. Part of their rhetoric was that if the state of California legalized same-sex marriage, their church would be forced to perform such marriages. In fact, that doesn't happen now if a church doesn't recognize, if a pastor or a particular church group does not recognize an interfaith couple, they don't have to perform or bless that union. And the second side of the rhetoric was based upon the fact, well, if it's legal, then I'm going to have to tell my kids about it. They're going to learn about it in school. And if gay marriage is okay, homosexuality is okay. What's wrong with children learning that there are people out there who are different than them? That this world is a beautiful place with differences.
And most children are able to be compassionate.
Exactly. Compassion is where we go with this. Compassion is one of our central values in the humanist philosophy.
So bring us up to date. You said you got two different sides fighting this battle about whether or not...
Yes. So what happened was, unfortunately, we lost. We frankly lost. They had better rhetoric, and we lost. It was a horrible, horrible feeling. It was incredibly demoralizing. And then the court cases started. We got up to that one that made all the news headlines a few months ago, Perry versus Schwarzenegger. Essentially, those people who had their who were now prevented from getting married stood up and sued for their rights. The defendants, the proponents of Proposition 8, had two witnesses. The plaintiffs, the people against Proposition 8, had 19 witnesses standing up and saying a few things, such as traditional marriage is not between a man and a woman per se because of romance. Traditional marriage has been a constantly evolving animal. And what's interesting, the judge in this case, Vaughn Walker, he lectured them saying that just because you read it on the internet doesn't make it fact. And just because you claim you did a study doesn't mean that you did it correctly. And I think it's this is the central issue that connects humanism to the gay rights movement. The opponents of both the secular humanist movement and the gay rights movement rely on their ideas of absolute certainty based upon faith, not based upon evidence. And these issues are the issues that the council will be tackling in the next few months as we gain more of a grassroots effort. Youth issues, the AHA has been great in this. In Etowah, Mississippi, up until 2008, there was a racially segregated prom. Then, just this last year, there was a young woman, Constance McMillan, who went to her principal to let him know, I'm going to be going to our prom in a tux, and I'm bringing my girlfriend. And he said, well, you can't do it. Otherwise, if you come, we're not going to have a prom. And so the AHA, along with the generous benefactor, Lance Bass and Green Day, stepped in, and they threw a wonderful equality event. Secondly, we want to take on other issues of youth inclusion, such as working with Scouting for All to help end the public subsidized Boy Scouts discrimination of atheists, agnostics, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgenders, and the children of our people as well.
Now, Jason, a lot of our listeners, they see humanism as sort of this overarching umbrella that encompasses lots of issues, including LGBT rights. Now, there's also something that I guess the two movements have in common, which is this process of sort of self-identification and coming out. And October 15th is National Coming Out Day for the lesbian and gay, bisexual, transgendered population. So can you talk a little bit about that?
National Coming Out Day is a day that basically expresses that fundamental human right that's all too often overlooked and taken for granted, and that's not being ashamed of who you are. It's that you're not alone. It's not just to stand up on a float and get half naked in a song and cover yourself in glitter and dance to house music. It's to stand up and say that I'm okay and that I'm here and I'm a part of your community. You know me. I'm your relative. I'm your neighbor. I'm your friend. I'm the guy at the convenience store. I'm your lawyer.
It's that chance for people to connect with something, whether it's inside themselves or inside their community. It's just a day that represents that.
When it boils right down to it, the HRC, Human Rights Council's National Coming Out Day, is in the same sentiment as the purpose for the LGBT Humanist Council. The goal of the LGBT Humanist Council is for a future where people are not mistreated based upon their actual or perceived sexual orientation.
Well, I like that, Jason. And I think that that's a great note for us to end on.
If you would like to get involved, we would love you to get involved. If you're on Facebook, join us at LGBT Humanist Council. If you don't have Facebook and aren't interested in getting it, go to LGBT Humanists, that's plural, humanists.org. And also, we have speakers who can come and talk to you. We also participate in national and regional humanist events. In February, we have a speaker at the San Diego, my group as well, the Humanist Association of San Diego, is putting on the Southern California Secular Humanist Conference, February 4th, 5th, and 6th in San Diego. If you are experiencing the kind of weather that's going to make a snowman shiver, by all means, come on down. We have some wonderful speakers. We are honoring Mike Newdow with the Phil Paulson Secular Society Award. We have Dan Barker, Daryl Ray, DJ Grossi, Mr. Beauty. We have Royce Beckhart, Tom Flynn. We have Bobby Kirkhart of Atheists United. We have about 20 speakers. And Liz Lydell of the Secular Student Alliance is going to be working with us to put on a student leadership summit there.
Sounds good, Jason. Thank you so much. And good luck with your conference in February.
Thank you.
I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist and no Hindu. I am a humanist through and through. That means that I believe in me and in you. There's no Valhalla that we can tell. There's no Nirvana, and that's just swell. There is no heaven in which to dwell. Hey, but the good news is that means that there's no hell. I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist and no Hindu. I am a humanist through and through. That means that I believe in me and in you. Superstition, it's a human curse. It's in every holy book, chapter and verse. It's a system that they use to coerce all their followers into opening up their purse. I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist no Hindu. I am a humanist through and through. That means that I believe in me and in you.
That was a clip from Jim Corbett's I'm a Humanist, which he performed at AHA's 69th annual conference earlier this summer. Jim Corbett is not only an original musician, but he's also a business executive. And you might also recognize his name as he's contributed to various humanist publications, including AHA's own magazine, The Humanist. But before that was an interview that I did with Jason Fry, who is the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego, as well as the coordinator for the LGBT Humanist Council. If you'd like more information on either organization, you can view links to those on the show notes for this episode. Up next, we have another clip from AHA's 69th annual conference, which is the question and answer portion to Bill Nye's acceptance speech of the Humanist of the Year Award. But before I air that, I'm just going to play a short excerpt from his actual acceptance speech, just because there's a little bit that he references in that question and answer portion. So in case there are some listeners out there who haven't yet heard Bill Nye's acceptance speech, I don't want you to be lost. So short clip of the acceptance speech and then the question and answer with Bill Nye, the science guy.
I was very excited to do this talk tonight until just a few minutes ago. Someone came up to me and said, "Is Bill Nye your real name?" And I said, "It's William Nye." And that, everything was going fine. Right? But then he said, "Why did you change it?" I didn't really change it. So I'll just leave you with one more thought that I find so compelling. It is through science, the discovery of this process, that I came to be a skeptic, and I came to really embrace critical thinking, and I came to embrace the idea that you probably only get one shot at life, and so, roughly, don't blow it. I think about this also often. You know, if you live to be 82 and 7 weeks. Anyone here? 82 and 7 weeks. It depends on leap years. But 82 and some change, you get to go through your 30,000th day. 30,000 days. And when you're young, when you're in elementary school and stuff, 30,000 is uncountable. You can't imagine that many days. But if you go to the Coliseum, when the seats are all used, when the tarps are rolled back, and you get to sit in a different seat every day, you won't get halfway around. Now, I'm willing to admit that 102A is probably real similar to 103A, but still, you're not even going to get halfway around. And so that's why we really have to take advantage of every day, and we have to present our arguments that the scientific method and the process of science really is the best idea we've ever had to as many people as possible. But we have a tendency, all of us, to dismiss people who believe other things, to dismiss people from outside, to dismiss people that speak different languages. But I remember as a kid standing on the beach. This is in this story, I was in Delaware, which is a state back east, for those of you in Californians. The first state, the Diamond State. They haven't found any minerals there. They just thought it looks kind of cool at sunrise. The waves had little diamonds in them. Apparently. I stood there, and I remember our third grade teacher, Mrs. Cochran, had told us that there are more stars in the sky than grains of sand on the beach. And I remember thinking, I didn't articulate it in this way, I remember thinking at the time, "Mrs. Cochran, are you high?" I had some other way of saying it, but "Mrs. Cochran, there's a lot of sand on the beach. Lady, I mean, if you stand in Delaware, it's 1,500 nautical miles in each direction. There's nothing but sand. Sand. When you dig down, you shuffle your feet, there's more sand. When the tide goes out, there is sand. You look behind you, there is sand. It's a sand festival. Sand, sand, sand. Mrs. Cochran, there can't possibly... Yes, there are more stars than all of that." And it doesn't take you long to stand there and think, look, I really I really am not that different from a grain of sand. I mean, I am insignificant. I mean, if you look out at the so-called trackless ocean, if you go out there even a few nautical miles, you disappear. You have no idea where you are. Am I near Delaware? Am I near Papua New Guinea? You can't really tell unless you're very experienced. You look at the sea color. At night, you don't really know. So I remember thinking, I am just another speck of sand. And the Earth, really, in the cosmic scheme of things, is another speck. And the sun, an unremarkable star, nothing special about the sun. The sun is another speck. And the galaxy is a speck. I'm a speck on a speck, orbiting a speck, among other specks, among still other specks, in the middle of specklessness. I am not, I am insignificant, I suck. But then, my friends, with my brain, which is only this big, and if you ever met him, my old boss, even it must have been quite a bit smaller. But even he, we can imagine all of this, and it's with our brains that we can know our place in the universe. We can know our place in space, and that does not suck. That is worthy of respect. That is what's so great. That is what's so wonderful about humans. Thank you all very much. Thank you for this award. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, yes. If you don't mind, let's take questions. If you don't mind. Does anybody have a question?
So why did you change your name?
I'll tell you why. It's a good, why did I change my name? So my first grade teacher, whom I loved the way one does, Mrs. McGonigal, I had her for first and second grade, and she did this cool, this remarkable demonstration about oases, and I didn't know the term for it, but artesian wells. It's really fantastic. She used to call me William out of respect. But I wanted to be, if I may, one of the gang. William just seemed to have, like, nothing else, it had too many syllables. So I just kind of preferred being Bill. It made me feel grown up. And we still, many of us still look forward to me growing up. Yeah. The IRS, very satisfied with it, but not everybody. Is there another question? Yes.
I wanted to know, you've definitely seen the Symphony in Science videos on YouTube.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
What do you think of those as a tool of just... expressing how
so for those of you who haven't seen it, somebody did the modern expression, it's derivative of British English. Somebody did a mashup of Professor Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, whom you awarded last year. I haven't seen Neil since Thursday. So he has become a dear friend. Man, what a character, what a maniac. He threw Pluto out of the solar system. Yes! Yes, because it's not worthy of traditional planet status. So instead of being the last of the planets, it is now the first of the Plutoids. How cool is that? Do you want to be just another planet? Do you want to be Mercury? Or do you want to be a Plutoid? Come on. Well, it depends how fast you want to go, I guess. So hold it. This mashup of they took classical music, it's Mozart, isn't it? Somebody knows? And then they took Carl Sagan speaking, Neil deGrasse Tyson speaking, and what's his name, Bill Nye speaking. And they had us all going through our thing. And speck on a speck is an old theme with me. And Carl's idea, Professor Sagan's idea that the humans are one of the universe's ways to know itself. That's good. But I'll tell you, I think it's another example where we're preaching to the choir. But still, the more people watch it, probably the better. The longest journey begins with but a single step. And so if we chip away at this problem of critical thinking, maybe we can, dare I say it, change the world. Yes.
As a popularizer of science, what do you think the best way of combating global warming deniers and some people who don't believe in the reality of what we know as modern science?
We have to chip away at it. I mean, as I always say, I always challenge these people, why don't you believe in climate change? And I think it's just, it's literally too big. And it's very, it's almost completely generational. There's very few climate deniers who are young people. There are a few, to be sure. But most climate deniers are, if I may, of a certain age. So, but to put it in logic terms, not all old people are climate deniers, but almost all climate deniers are old thinkers. So this is a big problem, especially if you're a human and you want to have kids and grandkids and progeny. Climate change is a huge problem. And what a thing to be here in California with electric lights, cold, clean water, fabulous fish dinner or vegetarian dinner with fabulous beans, all good. And whereas if you're born in Central Africa, your view of the world is quite different. I was there. I was with kids who had never seen a magnet. It's really something. You watch a kid discover magnetism. It's really, man, it's really something. So I guess what I would always say is you try to share the passion, beauty, and joy of science. We can know the climate of Venus. We can know the climate of Earth. Isn't that cool? Don't you want to do something about it? So, and this oil spill, I mean, it's an opportunity, people. Let no crisis not be an opportunity. Maybe now, I'll just say I used to work in the oil patch in the oil industry briefly, just 2 years as a young engineer. I left because it was too low tech for me. There wasn't enough cool stuff, cool gizmos. There was too much welding and not enough drilling and tapping and threading, if you will. So this could be an opportunity because it shows you how just one well, you know, there are about 4,000 oil rigs around the world. Most of them are in much shallower water, but there are several hundred in very deep water, or if not deep water, very treacherous water. The North Sea off Norway is a difficult place to work. Anyway, it just shows you how much we rely on this technology. And I say to people, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. No. Don't let them grow up to be doctors and lawyers. No. Let them grow up to be engineers. That's what we need, people to solve these huge problems. So I'm hoping this disaster or this spill or this gusher will let everybody be aware of how much is at stake when you're working with such high pressures so far away in such a cold, corrosive environment. You know, much easier to explore the surface of the moon than the bottom of the ocean. Much easier. So things went wrong. And it's mostly, I'll tell you, as an engineer, it's mostly from lack of regulation. You know, the batteries were dead and the accumulator tanks, the pressure tanks, didn't have enough pressure in them. And this is, by the way, for those of you who don't love flying, that's the only thing that goes wrong with a modern airplane is when it's not maintained. So when you don't maintain the oil well, stuff happens. Now, one last thought, we'll get to the next question, sorry. 3,000 or 4,000 offshore oil rigs around the world, about 800,000 oil wells, the better part of 1 million oil wells. And many of my colleagues, scientists, want say what we need to address climate change is nuclear power. And it seems like, really, it seems like a reasonable thing. I mean, you dig up this nuclear material, you get some energy out of it, maybe not all the energy for safety, you get a lot of the energy, and then you put it back in the ground. This is fabulous, great idea. But when we get to have 10 or 20 or 40,000 nuclear power plants, there are going to be accidents akin to this oil well. And the consequences are just huge. They are huge, to put it. They're very big. They're huge. And so we really need to think about that. And I remind everybody, we have 5 times the energy in wind in North Dakota than we use in the United States. Well, I mean, that's a hard problem. We need to get if we were going to pick North Dakota, we need to get the energy from there to New York City or whatever. It's not an easy thing. But it sure seems like this is an opportunity to focus us pursuing renewable energy much more aggressively.
If you could give a recommendation to President Obama about dealing with overpopulation, what might you tell him?
Well, what you want to do is make sure girls get a good education. I mean, that's a fine thing for Uncle Bill to say. Oh, what we need to do is raise the standard of living in women. Okay, done. Okay, that's good. No, putting two rovers on the moon, putting two rovers on Mars that can drive around 6 years past their warranty, making these discoveries on Mars with a few dozen people working in Ithaca, New York, and a few dozen people working in Pasadena, California, that is child's play compared to, say, feeding people in Somalia. I mean, raising the standard of living of women is the key to lowering the Earth's population. But that is a difficult, difficult problem. But one that should be undertaken, my heavens. I mean, by heaven, by the stars. Excuse me. Next one.
Out of the two shows you did, which one was your favorite?
So you mean Stuff Happens versus Bill Nye the Science Guy? Versus The Eyes of Nye? Versus The 100 Greatest Discoveries or The Greatest Inventions? It just shows you how many shows you've never seen. I won't say because they sucked. That would be an exaggeration. Because they weren't as compelling, especially to people your age. If you decide to become a dancer on Broadway, if that's what you decide to do, I remind you, never say your favorite dance partner. Never reveal who your favorite dance partner is. Never say, what's Fred Astaire, not Gene Kelly, or that's in it, for example, or it's Gene Kelly, not Donald O'Connor. Never say that, because then the other guy is going to think you don't want to dance with him. So I will never say my favorite show. But I will say there is an element in every one of them that I really get a kick out of. And when I got a ride in the Blue Angels, the F/A-18 Hornet fighter plane, that was pretty cool. I'll say that was a high point, literally. I mean, how many people are fighter pilots? There's probably a couple. Are there a couple guys who've flown fighter planes? It's great. I mean, this is every shape. You know, I remind everybody, every shape in this room, every shape on a plane came out of somebody's head. And it's really believing in science. You know, the head guy, the boss, as he's called, he talks like this. He talks with this, let's stay calm, everything's fine. They practice talking this sort of Zen thing. And then adding power, adding power. The plane accelerates. It's just so cool. And then he says a little pull, which means pull back on the stick, and the elevators go like that, push the back of the plane down, the front goes up, you add an angle of attack, and it goes up. And your face goes like that. Just a little more pull. You can't keep your jaw closed. And then and that was all great, and that was well within my expectation. But the one that got me, and listen, I used to work at Boeing. I'm not trying to frighten anyone. But there's a 747. There's a hydraulic tube in the 747 that I kind of think of as my tube. It's about that long. It's still flying. I was very well supervised. Don't worry. It's all good. But I'm familiar with speed brakes. These are these panels. You've seen them. They come up on the wing. They're called spoilers. When you put one side up, some planes have speed brakes and spoilers, but most airliners, they're all one thing. And when you put them up just by themselves and it goes like that, that's a spoiler. But if you put them both up, those are speed brakes. Okay. Well, and by the way, speed brakes are different from brakes. They only work when you have speed. If you put the speed brakes up on the runway, on the tarmac there, and just push the plane, it'll go. Brake schmick. Yeah. So anyway, the fighter plane has the speed brake in the middle, in the back, right behind the pilot or your head. And so it's made of some amazing graphite fiber, super sex mobile, titanium, something or other. But it's kind of rectangular, so they call it a board. Just a board. You know, $10 million bucks a pop to board. So, you know, adding power, a little pull, your face going, and then the guy says, boards up, and the speed brake deploys, and it's just, your hands and feet go shooting like this. The oxygen mask pulls off your face. Oh, it's so cool. It's so cool. But I'm not going to say that was my favorite. Yes, over here.
Hey, Bill. Are you afraid of space aliens like Stephen Hawking? And what is your opinion of SETI?
SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, I think is a worthy thing for us to do, for us humans to do. If we were to discover evidence of somebody else, it would change the world. It would be like Galileo or Copernicus. It would be an insight that we are not alone. There's two questions that make us all crazy at some point. And if you haven't thought of these two questions, brace yourselves. Where did we come from? It makes everybody crazy. That's what many religions claim to have knowledge of. And then, are we alone? Those are the two questions that we in space exploration seek to answer. So I think putting a little bit of our wealth, a little bit of our treasure into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is quite worthy. I think it's a cool little thing for us to do in the background. Who knows what we will do? This is the thing. Why are you guys doing that? Why are you sending a mission to Pluto? What are you going to find? We don't know. That's why we're going. As far as Stephen Hawking's concerned, by the way, the Planetary Society gave Stephen Hawking the Cosmos Award, named after Carl Sagan, in February. We all went to Britain, went to Cambridge, hung out. It's very good. Beer is very good. And his fear that aliens will receive our signal and come here and eat us, it's too late, my friends. Gilligan's Island has been going at the speed of light from the Earth since it was broadcast. I'm sorry. Deal. You may be right. That's why they haven't, that keeps them away. Yes. That's right. Yeah, we should remind them. Yeah. Have you seen Divas of New Jersey? What is it called? Yeah, that would repel anybody. There's no question. So you may be onto something. Thank you. So, in other words, his fear, it's too late, Dr. Hawking. We got to just take the risk. Yes, next
okay,
one, please.
We have time for one more question.
Let's take two more. It's traditional not to just have it. Can we take this one and one more? Am I interceding? Yes. Okay, all right. So you think about the last question. Whoever gets it, don't blow it. Sir, you're penultimate. Pressure's on.
Well, I have 2 points, and they're very serious. I hate to break up this humor, but one point is that I think there's some research that indicates a positive thing about masses of people in big cities. We get more brain power, and there may be a chance that we can solve a lot of these things in an engineering context.
So let me point out that the big ideas, like we're here in Silicon Valley, the big ideas are when people get together. Very, very seldom does one person in the wilderness come up with a world-changing idea. And this was the charm and the compelling thing of the story of Philo T. Farnsworth. He was the guy who invented the first successful electronic television. But he was a guy in Utah who thought about the way his uncle had him plow the potato fields where he went to visit in Idaho every summer. And he realized what we ought to do is scan the picture. But that's a very unusual thing. Now, if you want a better iPhone, you better go to work where they make iPhones. And so cities are where people come up with ideas. And so cities are an important thing. I know not everybody likes them, but cities are a very important idea. So your next thing, sir.
Okay, the second point is a brand new book that just came out called Merchants of Doubt. And the idea is they've done research and found that a lot of the old Cold War physics scientists had been hired by the cigarette industry and now by the global warming critics.
So it's a conspiracy?
A very strong indication that huge sums of money have been paid by these big corporations to have these particular scientists develop the best stories or arguments in favor of the status quo. And it's a big thing right now.
Let me just say, as a skeptic, I've spent a lot of time with physicists. I wouldn't hire them to write good stories. I'm open-minded, but I just those are not the first guys I'd go to. And so you can complain about Hollywood, this and that, but those people who work there are expert at telling stories. You got to respect that one thing. So is this the last question? Or was that the last question? One more. Is there one more question? You pick. I can't take the pressure. I can't. They're pointing. They're pointing back there. He's got his hand up here. I can't take it.
Bill, with you as a science guy, I get many people kind of dismissing science, some of this postmodernism stuff. So
whatever. Yeah.
So I'm sure you can give us some wise words to combat this anti-scientific thought.
The wise words would be, we have to change the world, get into the passion, beauty, and joy of science. What's more fun than science? When you say, are you sure? Just ask yourself, when you meet somebody who's anti-science, is he just anti-you? You know, anti-me, or anti the person you're talking to. And it's very easy to be... to have a little more knowledge than, or better yet, to think you have a little more knowledge than somebody else. And I get a lot of email at my website. I mean, and I'm some guy. I'm a mechanical engineer that worked in the oil field 25 years ago. I'm not the world's foremost authority on oil spill cleanup, although I worked on oil slick skimming boats. But I've gotten about 1,000, maybe a few more than that, recommendations about what they should do about this oil spill. And at BP, my understanding is they've gotten 30,000. And one of the emails I did, it's hard to respond to all of them, but I did respond to one of them, and then you'll send a version of that to a lot of people. And it started out with, well, these so-called engineers clearly have no idea how to clean up oils. And I wrote to the guy, I strongly recommend that you not call the people that are working day and night on this the last 40 days idiots, because it's very likely that they won't listen to what the rest you have to say. And I will say, as a bitter, mean-spirited, evil person, I have the tendency, we all do, to be dismissive. You go, you don't know what you're talking about. That's crazy. And I fight that constantly. So that would be my last piece of advice is, just try to listen and see if you can figure out what it is that makes this person not want to believe in climate change, not want to accept that Venus is like the Earth, only a little different, to not want to question things. You know, I always think of Michael Faraday, and he was a European guy, he was a British guy. Sometimes they don't think they're in Europe, and I understand that. I'm sympathetic. It's none of my business. But this got very well researched on the Bill Nye the Science Guy show. I was presented with this story as a kid that it was the Queen of England who came up to Michael Faraday after one of his Christmas lectures. This was something that he did for children. It's called a children's lecture every holiday season in London. And he did a thing where he put a magnet through a coil and it moved a compass needle in another coil. And this was a new thing, because it was invisible. The magnetic field is not apparent to the naked eye at all. And I was told it was the Queen of England, but it was very well assured. It was just some normal person, some civilian came up to Michael Faraday and said, but Mr. Faraday, of what use is it? And he's supposed to have said, madam? And I can imagine him. Madam, of what use is a newborn babe? And if you think about it, newborn babes aren't very useful. They're loud, they leak, they're in trouble. Yet every single thing in this room owes its existence to that discovery, which we nominally call Faraday's Law, because it's the generation of electricity. And so that is so prophetic, is such an insight. Just ask people, what is it about it that you don't like? What is it about science that you don't like? And usually people just think it's over their heads, but it's not. Everybody knows what a magnet is in our society. Everybody knows wires. Everybody knows electricity. Everybody likes to drive their car. Everybody loves science. Just get them on your side. It's fun. It's the passion, beauty, and joy, the PB&J of science. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Of the brotherly, sisterly kind. If we leave all of our gods behind, it's amazing the peace the world could find. I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist, no Hindu. I am a humanist through and through. That means that I believe in me and in you. Celebrate life. It's the humanist way.
All right, folks, there you have it. AHA's 2010 Humanist of the Year, Bill Nye the Science Guy. You can, of course, stay up to date with all things related to Bill Nye the Science Guy, including his appearances and his blog, at his website, BillNye.com. That about wraps things up for this month. Before I let you go, I just want to let you know about an event that the American Humanist Association is hosting on October 29th, which is our open house and also sort of a pre-rally for Jon Stewart and Steve Colbert's October 30th Rally to Restore Sanity and March to Keep Fear Alive. So if you are standing up for reasonableness and rationality, or maybe if you're annoyed at the drone of Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin followers, join the AHA for an evening of fun. The night before the rally, meet our staff. We'd love to see some of you listeners out there. Maybe we can do some interviews. Let's have fun. Let's get ready for that rally on October 30th. So the address of the American Humanist Association can be found on our website, which is AmericanHumanist.org. Thank you so much for listening to the Humanist Hour. For information from this episode or to download or listen to any previous episode, just visit our podcast page, thehumanist.org. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And in one more time, I am no Christian, Muslim, or Jew. I am no Buddhist and no Hindu. I am a humanist through and through. That means that I believe in me and in you.